one of my favorite parashas, but it gets better next week and the week after. So you'll find that we'll be reading that chapter in Acts, that piece from Acts, for the next 3 weeks, because it all takes part of the story of Yosef. Well, you've got me again this week, but I promise you'll get Sean back next week. He must be sick of me by now. Okay, let's pray. Abba Father, we just pray that you will open our eyes to see what you have done and the wondrous things you've given me out of your Torah this day. And I pray that the words of my mouth and the thoughts of my heart are acceptable in your presence, because you, Yehovah, are my rock and my redeemer. And I ask this in Yeshua's precious name. Amen. Today I've titled my message, Faith Under Fire. And Yosef is a type or typology of Yeshua. So I want to look at him today and how we also can be Yosefs of this world. Yosef did nothing wrong, but he was persecuted and hated by his own brothers to the point that they sold him into slavery. I don't know your experience in life, but there are times in my life that I feel that my siblings have sold me into slavery, and I'm not joking. So I suppose I can identify with Yosef in this way. But let us look at what happened to him and his reaction to it as an example of our lives. The first thing that happened was that his brothers meant it all for evil. But, of course, they didn't know the end from the beginning. Can we go to Bereshit 37, 19 to 20? They said to each other, "Look, this dreamer is coming. So come now, let's kill him and throw him into one of those water cisterns here. Then we'll say some wild animal devoured him. We'll see then what becomes of his dreams." Joseph's story, as I said, he did nothing wrong, but was persecuted and hated by his own brothers, to the point of being sold into slavery. It is not a sin to dream. And I'm sure his brothers were acting out of jealousy, which is a sin. The scriptures teach that believers will have various kinds of problems here on earth. So if we can go to Jochanan chapter 16, please. It says in Jochanan 16, verse 33, "I have said these things to you," this is Yeshua, "so that united with me you may have shalom," or peace. "In the world you have zuris," that's trouble. Is there anyone here who hasn't had any trouble? Don't think so. "But," says Yeshua, "be brave, because I have conquered the world." Some of these trials that we have to take will be regular problems that are common to all human families. In Matityahu chapter 5, verse 45, it says, "Then you will become children of your Father in heaven. And he makes his sun shine on good and bad people alike. He sends rain to the righteous and the unrighteous alike." So there's other problems that are specific to believers. Attacks which are sent by the enemy to discourage us. It is really difficult being a believer. Try being a Jewish believer. That can bring more hassles than ever. In the next slide, in Kefa Aleph 1 Peter chapter 5 and verse 8, it says, "Stay sober, stay alert. Your enemy, the adversary, stalks about like a roaring lion for someone to devour." I suppose the problems that we find the hardest to understand, to cope with and overcome, are problems that have to do with our believing brothers and sisters. because they can cause more problems than not. Having worked in a Christian school, I think it was the worst place I'd ever worked at. Working in the state system was quite easy. The clientele wasn't as easy, but the staff was. In Tehillim and Psalms chapter 55, verses 12 to 14, it says, "For it was not an enemy who insulted me. If it had been, I could have borne it. It was not my adversary who treated me with scorn. If it had been, I could have hidden myself. But it was you, a man of my own kind, my companion, who I knew well. We used to share our hearts with each other. In the house of Yehovah, we walked with the crowd." Yeshua wasn't respected by his family, and as I spoke last week, he wasn't respected in his own hometown. And the scriptures call this type of problem an offense or abuse. The Hebrew word livzot, meaning a stumbling block, something that causes one to fail, something contrary to expectations that brings disappointment, or being the trigger of a trap. And in Luke 17, verse 1, Yeshua said to his Talmudim, "It is impossible that snares, livzot, will not be set, but woe to the person who has set them." An offence is like a bait in a trap. It is harmless unless we feed on it, but it is deadly when it is consumed. It is a fact of human nature that the closer the relationship, the more severe the offence. The most vicious legal cases, such as divorce, proves that is why problems among brethren can be so severe. Yeshua said it's impossible to live in this life and not have the opportunity of not being offended. The question is not, will you encounter this trap, but how will you respond to the trap when it's been laid to snare you? One of the signs of the end times is that many will be offended. Look at our world today. We cannot say the truth. We cannot have the freedom of speech because it will offend someone. We have to use politically correct language. Otherwise, we will offend someone. This is we are at end times. This is what the scripture says. In Matthew chapter 24, verses 10 to 13, it says, "At that time, many will be trapped into betraying and hating each other. Many false prophets will appear and fool many people. And many people's love will grow cold because of increased distance from Torah. But whoever holds out till the end will be delivered." How many people follow Torah today? Those that read the scriptures, the Torah that we read every week in this our congregation, are very rarely read in any other Christian church or any other entity. Even in Israel, when we go to a messianic community in Israel, they do not read Torah. You were blessed to go to one that did. We couldn't find one, and we've been to Israel a couple of times. And it is hard to find a congregation in Israel that will read Torah. But they'll have their gay synagogue, that's okay. Just don't read Torah. Keep away from it. But the problem is that Torah is the basis of everything. Yeshua came purely and simply because they weren't following Torah. They were following what the Pharisees and the Sadducees were teaching, which is the Babylonian Talmud of today. And many of them won't listen to Torah at all. And yet Torah is the basis of everything. It is the foundation. If we don't have Torah, we have nothing. Notice that Yeshua warns of prophets immediately after his prophecy of many being offended. Yeshua called false prophet wolves in Matthew chapter 7 and verse 15 because they prey on the wounded, young sheep, not strong, healthy ones. False prophets tell people what they want to hear, not what they need to hear. And offended people are easy prey. Strong cities of ancient times had walls built all around them as their assurance of protection. They kept unwelcome inhabitants and invaders out. All entrances were screened. Those owing taxes were not allowed in until they paid. Those considered a threat to the city's health or safety were kept out. It'd be nice if we could do that today, wouldn't it? Mishlei Proverbs. It says, it's harder to win an offended brother than a strong city. Their fights are like the bars of a fortress. We construct walls around ourselves when we are hurt to safeguard our hearts and to prevent future wounds. And this is a natural thing to do. We become selective, denying entry to all who fear will hurt us. We filter out anyone we think who owes us something. We withhold access until these people have paid their debts in full. And I know I'm one of these people. I'm not speaking just, but I'm thinking it's just you. I know I'm one of those people. I have a policy in life. Because I've been hurt so many times, I'm autistic. My family have never, it was never diagnosed when I was young. And I've always been the different one in the family. I've got to the stage in my life where I will only go where I am celebrated and not tolerated. And that means not being around my family at times. Because there's a pecking order. I might be the third child in the family of five, but I'm in a pecking order of six because I have a cousin that's been brought in. And I'm at the bottom of that pecking order. I choose not to go. They're actually having a Christmas party tomorrow with my mother, Monday with my mother. I'm not going. I chose not to go. One, I hate Christmas, always have. And two, I'm not going to be in that pecking order to go through what I have to go through just to be with my mother, who has severe dementia, is 99 years of age and won't remember who was there anyway. Don't put yourselves through it. You don't need to put yourself through it. You've got to look at where you're going to be celebrated. Come to Shabbat. We celebrate everyone here. Everyone is loved and celebrated. There's no pecking order. You know, Malachi and I would do just as much of the menial things as anybody else. There's no pecking order. You are all welcome. We have to make sure that our walls of protection don't cause us to be in a prison, though. We shouldn't put them up so high that we block ourselves off from going anywhere. If we come to that point, we are not only cautious about who comes in, but could be in terror of future injuries that we cannot venture outside of our fortresses at all. So if left unchecked, an offence can turn into bitterness and we can cut off our noses to spite our faces. We go to the next slide, please. In Hebrews chapter, or Messianic Jews chapter 12, verse 15, it says, see to it that no one misses out on Yehovah's grace, that no root of bitterness springing up causes trouble and thus contaminates many. If roots are nursed, watered, protected, fed, and given attention, they increase in depth and strength. If they are not dealt with quickly, roots are hard to pull up or pull out. As the offence grows, many people are corrupted. Francis Frangipani said, "Bitterness is unfulfilled revenge." We mustn't hold bitterness within our hearts. Imagine how different Yosef's story would have been if he had yielded to the sin of offence. But Yosef refused to let another sin affect his relationship with Yehovah. Yosef lost all of his inheritance and freedom, but still he had the right to choose his response. Yosef chose to forgive. In fact, if Yosef had been offended, he would have later have killed his brothers. When he could have rehearsed his offence, he could have chosen to reverse it. To look at Yosef's perspective, we need to go to Bereshit, Genesis 50, verse 20, which we won't be doing, which we didn't do this week, where he says to his brothers, "You meant to do me harm, but Yehovah meant it for good, so that it would come about as it is today, with many people's lives being saved." Yosef let Yah settle the balances instead of trying to do it himself. During his trials, Yosef could not see that his offences were preparing him to rule and would result in his family's salvation. He could not see the end from the beginning. If Yosef had yielded to his bitterness and killed his brothers, he could have not been saved. We all know that Yehuda was the ancestor of Yeshua HaMashiach. So without Yosef, we wouldn't be here today. Excuse me. No Yeshua. So we needed Yosef. We needed his example. During his trials, I've said that. Forgiveness is the only cure for offence. When we forgive, we release the power of Yehovah to bring good out of bad situations. That also means forgiving yourself. And that's one of the hardest things to do. We are all human. We all make mistakes. But we mustn't hang on to them. Let yourself forgive yourself. Because sometimes we can hang on to things and not let them go. And that becomes a root of bitterness inside us. Can we go to Romans 8 and verse 28, please? Furthermore, we know that Yehovah causes everything to work together for the good of those who love Yehovah and are called in accordance with his purpose. Excuse me. I took my children to the water park down at Broadwater Parklands yesterday, my grandchildren, and I'm sitting in this smoke all this time and it's still affecting my voice because I'm allergic to smoke. But even the smoke in the air affects me and takes a while for it to go. But I'm sure that we are all guilty of assigning blame. If it weren't for so-and-so, then I did it up. Therefore, my disappointment is my fault. Sorry, is their fault, not my fault. Can I assure you that absolutely no man or adversary can get you out of the will of Yehovah? Only you can thwart the will of Yah in your life. And that's by getting offended. And I've seen it with my own children. My own sons were offended in a church when they were 14 and 19. and never went back because they let that root of bitterness seed inside them. So let us now look at the next part of Yosef's situation where he leaves his robe. In Bereshit 39, 6b to 12. Now Yosef was well built and handsome as well. In time the day came when his master's wife took a look at Yosef and said, "Sleep with me." But he refused, saying to his master's wife, "Look, because my master has me, he doesn't know what's going on in this house. He has put all his possessions in my charge. In this house I am his equal. He hasn't withheld anything from me except yourself, because you are his wife. How then could I do such a wicked thing and sin against Yehovah?" But she kept pressing him day after day. Nevertheless, he didn't listen to her. He refused to sleep with her or even be with her. However, one day when he went in the house to do his work and none of the men living in the house was there indoors, she grabbed him by his robe and said, "Sleep with me." But he fled, leaving his robe in her hand and got himself outside. Yosef ran out of the house, leaving his master's wife hanging onto his robe. As believers, we must live pure lives. We mustn't even put ourselves in a situation where it doesn't look right, where it can look wrong. So married men should never have a single girl in the car by themselves. It's not right. Because people can get the wrong impression. I know Malachi picks up Izzy from the tram station twice a week, but she could be his granddaughter. She's young enough. And she lives in our home. So she is under our control. But I'm talking about picking up people and taking them places and doing things with them. Everything has to be above board. It can't look wrong. In 1 Timothy chapter 2 and verse 8, it says, "Likewise the shamashim," that is the servants, "must be of good character, people whose word can be trusted. They must not give themselves to excessive drinking, be greedy or to dishonest, or be greedy for dishonest gain." So there are at least three benefits of a pure life. One is salvation. It Matityahu 5:8, which says, "How blessed are the pure in heart, for they will see Yehovah." Two, we've got confidence. Messianic Jews, Hebrews, says, "Therefore, let us approach the holiest place with a sincere heart in the full assurance that comes from trusting." We can have confidence that we are doing the right thing. And three, we've got the anointing of the Ruach HaKodesh. In Messianic Jews, Hebrews 1 and chapter verse 9, it says, "You have loved righteousness and hated wickedness. Therefore, O Yehovah, your Elohim, has anointed you with the oil of joy in preference to your companions." But you might say, "The world tempts me to have an impure mind and life. While I'm trying to lead a decent, restrained life, TVs and movies propagate the notion that everybody else is having a wild, debauched time that I might be missing out on." And this is true, the true power of the mass media. The power to redefine normal. The harmful behaviour that we see glamorised not only conveys powerful messages of what's accepted, but also of what is expected. The unreal world of the media becomes, over time, a self-fulfilling prophecy. This leaves our young people of today completely confused. We're trying to raise them in a way that they'll live in purity, but they see in movies, on TV, just in shows that are on at 7 o'clock, at night. It shows that are just immoral in every way, shape or form. In reality, the University of Chicago showed that both sexual satisfaction and frequency is greater among married people than among single people. But in TV or Hollywood, lust is prevalent, and the only kind of sex that seems to be banned is intimacy between a husband and a wife. A sociologist from a university, James Q. Wilson, points out a curious fact. He says, on city streets where broken windows have gone unrepaired, the crime rate immediately soars. Why? Broken windows make an announcement to the public. Here, the standards have been broken down. Here, no authority applies. Do what you like without consequences. TV and movies have become a gigantic broken window to the world. The portrayal of life without standards and behaviours without consequences sends out a message of impurity, that impurity is normal. The media is a seducer, and I'm not going into the ways it seduces the viewers of today, and especially our young people. But the increase of debauchery and crime in our society speaks to what the media classes as normal. It would be laughable if the effects were not so tragic on our society. The sad thing is that the church, not just the Messianic community, but the Christian church as well, have not escaped. The distinction between the world and so-called Christianity is quickly evaporating. 19% of believers watch mainstream TV, where 24% of non-believers. 70% of believers subscribe to cable television, which is equivalent to 70% of non-believers. 9% of believers watched an X-rated movie in the last 3 months, 16% of non-believers. 27% of believers have been divorced, 23% of non-believers. So there's been more divorces within Christian communities than there have been of the secular community. But then once again, more of the secular community live together and don't get married. So those figures could be a little bit off skew. So I'll not go into the information I found in a Christian singles journal on the sexual activity of single Christian men, because that would blow your mind. We need Jehovah's word if we're going to have a pure mind. We have to trust him and what his word says. Let us go to Tehillim, Psalm 119, verse 11. And King David said, I treasure your word in my heart so that I won't sin against you. And in Romans 12, 2a, in other words, do not let yourselves be conformed to the standards of the Olam Hazeh, that is, the standards of this world. Scriptures teach that there's five kinds of sexual immorality. One, sex before marriage with anyone, known as fornication, even if divorced. People seem to think if they've been married once and then they're divorced, that doesn't count. It does. Sex after marriage with anyone but your spouse is adultery. Sexual activity with anyone but your spouse is adultery. Sexual activity by oneself for the purpose of sexual arousal is sinful, and lustful thoughts are sinful. Matityahu 5:28 says, I tell you that a man who even looks at a woman with the purpose of lusting after her has already committed adultery with her in his heart. And there are ways to avoid sexual temptation. I have to admit it's harder in the Western world. Malachi and I have, as you know, have been to India on numerous occasions, and we've been to Israel. Both of those countries, the women wear long clothes, their hair's usually covered, their arms are usually covered, and they are not wearing anything inappropriate. And therefore, that doesn't cause men to sin. But then you come to live on the Gold Coast here, and you just have to go for a walk down the Broadwater, and women are in the skimpiest of bikinis and the lowest of clothing, and a man doesn't know where to turn his head because it's in his face. It's the complete opposite. It's there. The temptation is there. And it's there for our young men in particular. And so they can't get guided in the right way because people don't dress appropriately. Women don't dress appropriately in particular, especially in our Western culture. We have to realize that sexual sin hurts Yehovah. The prevailing attitude seems to be, I love to sin, Yah loves to forgive. Can I assure you that that attitude breaks the heart of Yehovah? Dietrich Bonhoeffer said, when lust takes control, at that moment, God becomes quite unreal to us. Two, we have to recognize the consequences of sexual sin. In Proverbs chapter 6, verse 32, he says, he who commits adultery lacks sense. He who does it destroys himself. I love the Proverbs. I read them every day. It's got so much in it that it's just basic for everyday living. I want to speak now on how to manage the dream. As I said in the beginning, Yosef had a dream. In Bereshit 37 and verse 5, it says, Yosef had a dream which he told his brothers, and that made them hate him all the more. In Bereshit 40 and verse 5, it says, one night the two of them, the king of Egypt's cupbearer and his baker, there in prison, both had dreams, each dream with its own meaning. And then in verse 8 of Bereshit, for chapter 40, verse 8, they said to him, that's Yosef, we each had a dream and there's no one around who can interpret it. Yosef said to them, don't interpretations belong to Yehovah? Tell it to me, please. So Yosef's dream was the grandest of all. Yosef had the grandest of personal dreams that anyone in the Tanakh or the Old Testament. Yehovah revealed to him that his brothers, the forefathers of the tribes of Israel, would bow down to him. In retrospect, it is apparent that had it not been for Yosef's intervention, the future Hebrew nation would have perished in that terrible famine of his day. But like most scriptural characters, the road to Yosef's dream was long and it was rough. We have a different perspective on his life than he had at the time. Someone said that hindsight is 20/20 vision. Yosef did not know the end of the story. All he knew was his dream had been shattered by the cruel actions of his brothers. In Bereshit 37:19-20, it says, they said to each other, look, this dreamer is coming, so come now, let's kill him and throw him to one of these water cisterns here. Then we'll say some wild animal devoured him. We'll see then what becomes of his dreams. For many people, such a setback would have been the end of the road, because their attitude from that point on would have done them in, but not Yosef. The next time we see him, he is involved wholeheartedly in making the dreams of others come true, including the dreams of Paro, which we'll read about next week. Yosef had many reasons to remain uninvolved and not give his energy to the dreams of others. One, his dreams were not coming true. Why should I help others when my dreams aren't being answered? His brethren had done him wrong. And three, his circumstances were definitely unfair. Your attitude determines your actions. Here are the sayings of a few people that can help with our attitude to a situation. We go to the next slide, please. The greatest discovery of my generation is that human beings can alter their lives by altering their attitude of mind. That was William James, a psychologist. Another one, a successful man is one who can lay a firm foundation with the bricks others have thrown at him. I like that one. That was David Brinkley, who's a television journalist. The last of our human freedoms is to choose our attitude in any given circumstances. That was Viktor Frankl. He was a psychologist and Holocaust survivor. And that's why he survived the Holocaust. Pity is one of the noblest emotions available to human beings. Self-pity is possibly the most ignoble and incapacitating. A crippling emotional disease that severely distorts our perception in reality. A narcotic that leaves its addicts wasted and derelict, according to Eugene Peterson. Regardless of his circumstances, Joseph's attitude was still the attitude of a servant. Because Joseph refused to remain uninvolved, which maybe would have been the tendency of one who had taken offense, Yehovah blessed him as he served. In Bereshit 39 and verse 2, it says, Yehovah was with Joseph, and he became wealthy while he was in the household of his master, the Egyptian. And further down in verses 5 and 6, from the time he appointed him manager of his household and all his possessions, Yehovah blessed the Egyptian household for Joseph's sake. Yehovah's blessings was on all he owned, whether in the house or in the field. So he left all his possessions in Joseph's care, and because he had him, he paid no attention to his affairs except for the food he ate. Now Joseph was well built and handsome as well. And we know what happened there, which causes Joseph to be thrown in jail, which we saw today. So Bereshit 39:22-23 says, the prison warden made Joseph supervisor of all prisoners in the prison, so that whatever they did there, he was in charge of it. The prison warden paid no attention to anything Joseph did, because Yehovah was with him, and whatever he did, Yehovah prospered. Even though Joseph had been taken from his family, no matter what adversity came his way, Yehovah was with him, Yehovah blessed him. So now we come to the interpretation of the cupbearer's dream. In Bereshit 40, 12-15, and then again verse 23, Joseph said to him, here is its interpretation. The three branches are 3 days. Within 3 days, Pharaoh will lift up your head and restore you to office, that you will be giving Pharaoh his cup as you used to when you were his cupbearer. But remember me when it goes well with you. Show me kindness, please, and mention me to Pharaoh, so that he will release me from this prison. For the truth is that I was kidnapped from the land of the Hebrews, and here too I have done nothing wrong that could justify putting me in this dungeon. And we get to verse 23 and it says, nevertheless, the chief cupbearer didn't remember Joseph, but forgot him. Just imagine how Joseph was feeling. He still couldn't get anyone to acknowledge that he was without sin. Whilst all this was happening in Egypt, Joseph's brothers in Canaan had lied to their father, and they are unaware that Joseph is still alive. In Bereshit 37:31-35, they took Joseph's robe, killed a male goat and dipped the robe in his blood. Then they sent the long-sleeved robe and brought it to their father, saying, we found this. "Do you know if it's your son's robe or not?" He recognized it and cried, "It's my son's robe. Some wild animal has torn Yosef in pieces and eaten him." Yaakov tore his clothes and put sackcloth around his waist, mourning for his son for many days. Though all of his sons and daughters tried to comfort him, he refused all consolation, saying, "No, I will go down to the grave to my son mourning." And his father wept for him. It will be 20 long years before Yaakov will see Yosef again. That's a long time for an old man. But worse than that, he will spend those years agonizing over the death of a son who is not really dead. And this is the ultimate torment of the mind, a needless agony, a pointless sorrow, a senseless despair. Yaakov's dream was not dead. It was only delayed. And Mishlei Proverbs says, and I love this one again, in chapter 13 and verse 12, "Hope deferred makes the heart sick, but desire fulfilled is a tree of life." When you receive gems like this, how can you not read a proverb a day? Yaakov was not just disappointed because his expectations and hopes were dashed. His plans for his favored son were frustrated. He was devastated and prepared to go to death, his death, mourning his favorite son. Yehovah did not arrange the events of his life or provide him with the fulfillment of his dreams in the way Yaakov thought best. But Yah is still at work, and one day he would hear the words, "Yosef is still alive." Even when we are disappointed in our situation, Yah is still at work behind the scenes. Remember your dream. It's not dead. It's only delayed. Someone has tried to kill or silence the dream. Yosef was Yaakov's favorite son, his dream. Yosef's brothers threw that dream in a pit and sold it to slavery in an attempt to snuff it out. Potiphar's wife hated the dream, falsely accused it, and sent it to an Egyptian jail. But the dream wouldn't die. A dream from Yehovah cannot be killed or silenced by external forces. Only we can choose to let that dream die by killing it from within. Yirmiyahu chapter 20 and verse 9 says, "But if I say, I don't think about him, I won't speak in his name anymore, then it seems as though a fire burning in my heart, imprisoned in my bones, I wear myself out trying to hold it in, but I just can't do it." And in Yochanan Aleph, 1 John 4 and verse 4, "You children are from Yehovah, have overcome the false prophets, because he who is in you is greater than he who is in this world." Maybe you have done something to hurt or delay your dream. Every one of us has done something that from time to time will let Yah, others, or ourselves down. Sometimes we've hindered the will of Yah in our lives by our own actions. But he doesn't hold that against us. He waits for us to step back into his plan. Yehovah's purposes may be delayed, but they will not be denied. 2 Timothy 2:13 says, "If we are faithless, he, Yehovah, remains faithful, for he cannot disown himself." Your failure is not fatal unless you let it be. It doesn't matter what mistakes you have made. Once you have come back into his kingdom, all those mistakes are gone. When I was a child, I would spend my school holidays on a dairy farm owned by a family friend. And one of their sayings was, it doesn't matter how much milk you spill, as long as you don't lose your cow. You can spill as much milk as you like. This was in the days before we had milk, proper milking machines. We did have a kind of a milking machine, but we had to start the cow off and then we had to put in the milking machine, each one separately, and then we had to then strip the cow after we'd finished milking it. It wasn't like a common day milking machine. I'm talking about the 1950s here, so that's 60 odd years ago. So maybe you are in a time of personal famine. The famine in Canaan was one of the hardest things Yaakov's family had to go through. People were dying all around them. But what Yaakov didn't realize was that Yehovah allowed that famine in order to make him look at Egypt and Yosef for help. We will go into more of that in our readings next week. But to finish my message, let us go to Tehillim Psalms 37, verses 23 and 24. Yehovah directs a person's steps, but he delights in his ways. He may stumble, but he won't fall headlong, for Yehovah holds him by the hand. And Romans 8:28, which we've said before, furthermore, we know that Yehovah causes everything to work together for the good of those who love Yehovah and are called in accordance with his purpose. The dream had been alive for 20 years, but Yaakov has not known it. Finally, he has a chance to rediscover his dream in our reading next week. How are you going to rediscover your dream? Realize that your dream is still calling to you. Yaakov has long since stopped inquiring about Yosef, but Yosef was still inquiring about Yaakov. Go back and pick up your dreams. They'll be right there where you left them, but you have to make the journey. I want to finish with this last slide in Revelation chapter 3 and verse 8. It says, I know what you are doing. Look, I have put in front of you an open door, and no one can shut it. I know that you have little power, yet you have obeyed my message and you have not disowned me. Can I ask you, turn your attitude from mourning to faith. Yaakov had to believe the report about Yosef and stop mourning. After believing his son for 20 years, it would have been very hard for him to believe that he was now alive. He had to change a 20-year-old attitude if he wanted to rediscover his dream. And I want to finish with this. We can look at life two ways. We can see the glass half full or half empty. Which do you choose? Let me tell you that my choice is neither. Neither of those do I choose. No matter what is going on in my life, I see my glass full and running over with the blessings and providences of Yehovah. But to do that, we have to submit everything to him. And for that reason, I believe that Yosef is a very good example to follow. Has anyone got any questions before we go to the... Any questions? Okay, we will go to the remembrance service.